Welcome to Space Coast meeting of April 24th, 2010. Would you all please rise for the Pledge of Allegiance? Pledge of Allegiance to the flag, the United States of America, and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, liberty and justice for all. I have just a few announcements to make before we get into the program. First, I would like to thank everyone that was involved in putting the trade show together. The trade show was an absolute success from everything that the vendors have responded back to me. And we, thanks, Steve. And I would just like to mention that without all of their help, and the trade show just never would have gotten off the ground. Bill, Ben, Gary, you did a hell of a job. And we really appreciate it, and the vendors really appreciate it. During the last President's Forum meeting that we had, they decided to have a meeting with AT&T regarding this U-verse system that they have to help or replace the bulk cable issues. If any, the turnout was outrageous. The people were very well informed, and they're to a point where they would like to set up another meeting. And if any of you did not attend that meeting and are interested, go to our website and please contact Ron Aldridge on the board of directors, and he can give you more information as to exactly what's going on with that and where it stands right now. The next President's Forum meeting will be May 8th. And with regards to today's program, we have Citizens Insurance to speak to us on a number of issues that do affect associations, and they're also going to touch on the topics of why you should be videoing your complexes prior to disasters, and how it can possibly help you with your claims. Any questions that you have, please put them on index cards. Board members will pick them up, and this way everything will be recorded. And we also will have the DVDs available. Just contact me at, via email, and I'd be more than happy to put you on the list to send you the DVDs. So today our speakers are Mr. Paul Palumbo, who is the Senior Vice President of Underwriting for Citizens Insurance. The Senior VP is responsible for reviewing, underwriting, profit-loss ratios, and developing solutions through product development and rate structure. Impressive. Then we have Ms. Susan Murphy, the Executive Vice President for Corporate Operations at Citizens. In this position, she oversees the human resource functions, purchasing and facilities, facilities management, consumer and agent services, and legislation activities. So without any further ado, I would like to present our two speakers from Citizens, Paul and Suzanne. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning to all of you. Can you hear me? Without a no? I'll try to talk louder. Yeah. I'm going to spend just a couple of minutes, because I just feel compelled to do it, to explain what Citizens is, so you understand what we are and how we got created and what our role in the marketplace in Florida is. And then our purpose for being here is to answer your questions and to provide information to you and to provide you with handouts that we hope will be helpful to you and hope you never need them. But our purpose in being here is to inform and to spend time with you and to discuss what Citizens does and who we are. So I don't want to talk a long time. I want you to talk. So just give me a couple minutes to give you some background, and then we'll launch into your questions. Florida has known that it's had a hurricane problem for a long time. In the 1970s, the Florida legislature created an organization that wrote just wind coverage. and it would issue a policy that just covered wind. A lot of you probably had a policy from the former Florida Windstorm Underwriting Association. So we've known since the 70s and probably before that that we had a problem. And we've always had a structure that relied on assessments after a loss. Okay, do you know what I mean? We know we don't have enough money to fund all of our hurricane exposure up front. Policies were sold, premiums were collected, but there was always the possibility that if we had losses that were greater than the premiums that were collected, that there would be assessments to pay off those losses. So that structure was developed in 1970, so we've had it for 40 years. In 2002, actually in 1993, after Andrew, the legislature came together again and said, we have a huge problem. We've got about a million people who've got nowhere to go for coverage. And they created another organization to provide coverage throughout Florida. So we had a wind pool, an organization that just wrote wind, and we had another organization that wrote full coverage statewide. And in 2002, the legislature said, let's take those two organizations and put them together and name it Citizens. So we've had something like Citizens since 1970, but now we have a combination of two former organizations that were created and named Citizens. And what is Citizens? It's not a government agency, but it is a government entity. I'm not a state employee. I don't participate in the state retirement system. And I'm not funded. Our operations are not funded by the state of Florida like a state agency is. But we're a government entity. And that means that we operate on a not-for-profit basis. So we don't have shareholders, stockholders. You are our shareholders. We don't operate on a profit motive. We don't pay federal income tax. We're a tax-exempt organization. And we operate as a public service for all the people of Florida. So we're not trying to make money. We're trying to provide you with coverage. We're trying to pay claims. We're trying to be an efficient organization. We're a government entity. We don't have a profit motive. And a lot of people don't understand that. And to me, that's a critical distinction between us and any other insurance company. There's a law that created us. We didn't just wake up one morning and decide to create Citizens. The legislature created us, and they said, we want you to provide coverage in Florida for homeowners and businesses who can't find other coverage. And we have about a million of you that can't find other coverage, and you're insured with Citizens. We issue policies in every county of Florida. We issue wind policies, and we issue full-service policies, and we issue business policies, and we insure tenants, and we insure homeowners, and we insure condominium unit owners, and we insure condo associations. We have the largest share of the condominium association market in the state. We have about 350,000 to 400,000 wind-only policies and about 600,000 of the multi-peril policies. People don't realize that we don't just insure coastal property. The bulk of our insurance is from other parts of the state. And it's not high-priced beach homes. It's low-value dwellings. It's mobile homes. It's condos. It's older homes. There's the policies that cannot find coverage anywhere else. So our role is to function as a mechanism, for lack of a better word, to provide coverage in times when the regular insurance market, your household names, aren't writing coverage. And that's what's happening now, and that's what's been happening for the last several years. The market is contracting. Coverage is less available. And so Citizens is here to provide coverage and to fill in those gaps and to give people an option for coverage that otherwise might not be there. In 2006, in a single day, we grew by 300,000 policies. We were, by law, required, but yet we actually were collaborative in this effort. We took over 300,000 policies from a failed insurance company in the middle of hurricane season and started to write business for these new insureds. So our numbers swelled dramatically in 2006, but since then, we've sort of leveled out, and we're still at a million policies, where our highest peak was probably about almost 1.4 million policies. But now we're about at a million. We've been sort of static for the last couple of years. And part of that is due to the fact that other companies look at the business and citizens and they decide they'd like to take some of those policies. So we have a program that facilitates other companies taking some of our risks and providing coverage to you directly. That's been a very successful program. And some of you may have been involved in one of those programs where your coverage was taken by another insurer. But there's a lot of misunderstanding about who we are. So Paul and I like to do these visits with people like you to explain who we are and to clarify our role and to answer your questions. So that's my little background of who Citizens is. So I think the next step will be, unless you want to say something. Actually, when Harry asked us to come and gave us some of the questions you were interested in, we took those questions and put them in, the questions and the answers, in this folder and brought copies with us so that you can take this home with you, read it at your leisure. We also have other handouts that we've prepared for speaking engagements like this one, including one that has our claims phone number on it, 24/7, 365 days a year. So you should keep this with your important paper, so if we have an event and you need to call us, you know how to do so. So I guess without further ado, I'll let Paul say good morning, and then we'll answer questions. Thank you.
We got to do something about this. Good morning, everybody. I would like to thank you for allowing us to come and participate in this.
Oh,
hey, how's it going?
Good morning, sir. This is for the video.
So,
if I can walk, I've got to go stand right next to the
podium. Don't stand behind the podium. We won't need to wire you up. So,
wire me up.
If you'd like to go, okay.
Put me in.
44 regular. All right. So, can everybody hear me now? I'm all mic'd up.
Okay. Good morning, everybody. Thank you for having us. You know, when Suzanne said that we had agreed to come, I was so excited that we were going to spend our Saturday doing this. I'm very happy about it. I'm just teasing. It is important for us. Suzanne and I take our responsibilities at Citizens very seriously and are happy to come out and spend time with folks to help them understand what Citizens is about, what laws are there that create what we do, and why do we do what we do, and we're happy to answer any questions that you have. So don't hesitate to be as frank and honest with your questions as you'd like. You won't hurt our feelings, and we'll do our very best to give you the answers. And if we don't know, we're extremely good at what we do, and we're very intelligent, but sometimes we don't know the answers, and if we don't, we are absolutely committed to finding out the answers and getting them back to you. So I need this microphone.
Both? All right. I feel like I want to sing when I have this microphone in my hand, though. I just find a video. Does it help you if I'm not as mobile as I want to be?
No, go right ahead.
All right. We do have some questions. I'll go ahead and just get into the written questions, and then we can just go along as you all would like. The first one, and I'll do my very best, Builder had our insurance for 3 years. There wasn't a problem. The association took it over and got a new insurance rep. 6 months later, we're told it had no sprinkler, and we did. Can I ask who wrote this? Is that okay? So are you saying that you were receiving a sprinkler credit and then it was taken away, or you applied for one and... Right. Okay. Right. So you currently are not receiving a credit for the sprinkler, is that your... You are. Okay. Okay, very good. So that one has been resolved?
Yes.
Well, you're welcome. See, that was easy. I like those. I don't mean to be trite about that. It's sprinklers, just for a moment. There is an organization that sets the standards for a lot of what we do, and it's called the Insurance Services Office, ISO. And that organization standardizes much of the insurance coverages and protection and credits and mechanisms that we use, as does the industry. And one of the things with regard to sprinkler credits that we go through is that to qualify for a credit, it has to meet all of the standards that are outlined by that organization. And so we go through great pains to ensure that we're giving credits appropriately, and that if a building is sprinklered, that we understand all of the workings of it and whether it meets the standard in order to qualify for credit. So if you ever have any concerns about that, anyone else, you can work with your agent or our commercial department. It's something that we do often, and we work with condo associations to help them understand what those standards are and how the inspection process can be performed to understand whether a sprinkler building meets the standards necessary for a premium credit. Is that useful at all? And then the second, we were told that you were 10 feet from tidal waters in Rockledge, and you're actually 10 miles. They said you had to pay total when you were paying your premium. So you were told that you had to pay the premium in full all at once?
Well, it was two things. First of all, they came up and said, you're 10 feet from tidal water. And it took us 6 weeks to get some weight on it. No one's not going to see where we're located.
Right. Right. Okay. Okay, good.
Then we could draw the program for counting the quarters and quarters.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, that doesn't make sense to me either. Well, please.
I don't know what happened, but we had a new representative, and I don't know if what he was filling out the paper would be those very aggravating things that happened. Just I don't know if he's put any blame on the company or what happened. So.
And thank you for that. So when you say a new representative, you got a new insurance agent?
Yes.
Right. And we do offer payment plans. So has that been resolved, or were you forced to pay? So it's all paid now? And
we're only like 6 months old, so we have to go out and borrow money.
Oh, geez. Right. It is. And these policies can be, an application for them can be very complicated. There's lots of information that has to be provided to us so we can make sure that we're issuing it properly and we're collecting the proper amount of premium and everything is being done as fairly as we can. So it is a complicated process oftentimes, but we are committed to working through and working through these issues the best that we can. I think it's important that we get, if there's anything we can do to resolve this one for next, your next policy term, if you need to stay with Citizens and there aren't any other insurers that are available, then we need to make sure that on the next term, that because we do have payment plan options available that you can take advantage of. We have not only pay in full, but there's a semi-annual payment plan and a quarterly payment plan that you can participate in. So we need to make sure that we do whatever we need to get you on that for the next policy term so you don't get into that situation again.
Right.
Sure. Right. Well, if you don't mind, I'd like to get some information about your policy so when I go back, I can review it to make sure that when the renewal comes out, that we do what we need to do to make sure that the payment plan options are available to you.
Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. The question is about the payment plan, whether there are fees or interest associated with it, and there are payment fees associated with it. I forgot what it is on commercial specifically. Do we have that in the?
No,
but there is a fee associated. It's just it's a fee that's much lower than what a private carrier would charge, but we did process. We do have a fee because it does cost us dollars to carry that debt and to process those payments. We don't use a. This is the payment plans that Citizens offers is actually managed by Citizens. There are other options available in the, out there through premium finance companies, but premium finance companies usually charge a really high interest rate. And Citizens only charges, we believe, we set the fees and structure at an amount that would allow us to process and manage the payment plans without losing money on it.
Your fee is about 6%.
Yeah. You know, I was going to say it's somewhere between 6 and 8%. There's a dollar fee, an actual straight dollar fee for personal lines and a percentage for commercial, and it is somewhere between 6 and 8%, I believe. And many premium finance companies charge, I think, north of 20%. Yeah. I'm going to go ahead and read the next question, if that's all right. Should an owner-resident that gives tennis lessons, I could use tennis lessons, on a condo association tennis court not pay for, not for pay, to non-residents be required to have his own liability insurance and get waivers from his students for association? Should the condo association that serves, oh, that's one question. You know, that's something that you'd have to really determine for yourself and work through with your own association. We don't offer any kind of liability protection or for commercial policies. Our condo unit owners' policies do have liability on them for personal liability. But what kind of professional liability that you might want to get to protect yourself and the association and that kind of for that kind of activity is something that I would recommend you work through with your insurance agent who can help you with that and the association. Does that make sense? The next part of this question is, should the condo association that serves alcohol, do we have any here? At the association parties in our clubhouse, be required to have the insurance rider called host liquor liabilities. Again, I think that's another one that that's not something that we are familiar with, given who we are, what our mechanism is. We're really allocated to property insurance for wind and fire, essentially, and don't really get into the liability section. So I would, again, recommend that you talk through that with your insurance agent and the association members to determine what kind of additional protection you might want to get for those kinds of activities. Okay. Whoa, these questions are coming now. Next question. A condo insurance policy, HO6, requires that policy names condo as a named association as a named insured and lost payee. Yes. Why doesn't policy name the condo by name as the lost payee and not require the owner to request that the insurance company to do it? This is from the Buccaneer Beach Club. Do you know? Yes. I know that the law requires that the condo association be listed on an HO6 policy. That's still a law, right? She always helps me. Keeps me straight. And we do that, and it's because I think the associations were concerned that that damage could be occurring to the building and that it wasn't getting fixed. So I'm going to hand the microphone over because I've said something wrong.
Oh, I think, does this work with just the handheld, or do I need to be mic'd? We can do that. I think the question, Paul, might be, why do they have to do it instead of us doing it just automatically? I think is that the question? Yeah, okay, now the answer to that is still what Paul said, is that the law requires that the unit owner put the condo on as an additional named insured, and so you have to do it. I'm not authorized to change your coverage for you. You have to do it because it's personal to you. So the answer is the law requires you to do it, and because you're the insured, you're the only one who should have the authority to add or delete named insureds from your policy. Now, I don't know, Harry is probably more up to speed than I am on the status of the bill that has been around for the last couple of years to try to change that requirement. I think it might pass this year, and it would delete the requirement that you add the condo association as an additional named insured. So stay tuned for the end of session next Friday to find out whether that's still a requirement. Yes, thank you.
Excellent. She is so much smarter than I am. Next question. Which insurance insurance form is used to inspect an individual unit on a multi-story condo. And it is the 1802 form, the OIR 1802 form. That is, if you work with individual condo unit owners, if you work with your insurance agent, they can help you understand what inspection and what criteria needs to be provided to qualify and to get any premium credits associated with building characteristics and wind mitigation credits. Is Citizens involved with the reinspection audit process in Broward and Dade counties on wind mitigation discounts given? And if so, are you aware that the inspectors doing the reinspections process are not qualified to do so? Yes. Next question. Now, we have received evidence and information that indicates that some of the information that we received and some of the premium credits we may be giving for building features isn't accurate. So we absolutely are in the process of building a reinspection program and a program not only for reinspections but for better documentation and better support for accurately describing and providing us with the information we need to understand what features are really there on a building and what credits are actually should actually be given. And that is a program that we're in the process of building, and it's not only in Southeast Florida, it's actually all across Florida for all of our policies. We just entered into a contract with an inspection management firm for 2010 for the rest of this year, and are also involved in an active procurement for ongoing inspection management services. So this is a huge project, this is a huge initiative, something we're taking very seriously, and the process will be that if your unit or your association is going to be reinspected, we will let you know, and then the inspector will schedule some time, come out, review, provide you with a copy of a very detailed inspection that describes and supports all of the features that are listed with documentation and photographs. And then our goal is to have a very clear and detailed explanation about any differences that are recognized from what was originally reported and what we have on your policy now to what we find in our inspection. Okay, so our goal is to have it very well documented, supported, so it's a rock solid determination of what features are actually present, and then a very clear and simple understanding and explanation of what any differences are. Yes, sir.
Yeah, I have a question. I'm the one that asked that question.
Okay.
The issue I have is this reinspection process is ongoing because not only the Citizens, I believe, enter into, but all the other major insurance carriers have got the system. Their insurance agent or the inspectors coming in to do the reinspections are not qualified to do so. So if you send myself or anyone in this room a letter saying we're going to reinspect your property to see what discounts you should or should not receive, I was under the impression that these individuals should be either engineers or contractors. The inspection process going on in Broward Day, and I know for a fact that the individuals doing these inspections are not qualified. So how do I know when I get a letter from you, a citizen, saying you're going to get re-inspected, this individual shows up, and he worked at Walmart for 3 years, and he's going to inspect my property. So,
well, I'm going to go ahead and disagree with you 100%, because I can guarantee you that the inspectors that we hire will absolutely be qualified and will be contractors, engineers, and other trained professionals that will help us to accurately document building features. We've only paid for 500 or 600 at this point through a pilot process. We haven't initiated the very larger initiative, That's good. We haven't initiated a larger project of fully reinspecting and getting really out there into all of our policies. So I don't think you can say that the inspectors that we're hiring and that we're sending out are not qualified, because I'm developing the qualifications for those inspectors, working with this inspection management firm to ensure that the people that we're sending meet the standards that we as citizens are creating, and they are very stringent to support the inspections and the process and the documentation of what we're getting back, to assure that when we hand you an inspection, it's going to be so well documented and so airtight that it's It's going to be a wonderful representation of what features you actually have, and a very clear explanation of what's there, and also a very clear explanation of what differences from what was originally reported were found, and what can be done to resolve those, or to just to gain an understanding of why we're saying something is different from the way it was originally reported.
Now, the contract confirm, what is the name of that contract firm that you all are, is it Skytech?
Skytech is an inspection firm. The inspection management firm that we're using is Inspection Depot out of Jacksonville. Mm-hmm. And Sky, we did use...
Well, that's one of the... I know an inspector that... I'm not sure if you're using Skytech, but Skytech is using the Broward Dade County inspectors that are not qualified to do the reinspection on residential properties. And I don't know if that's what you're using or about to use, but the documentation on the 1802 new form that you all just released yesterday or two days ago, actually has the MyState Florida home inspection individuals. That was kind of a menagerie of inspectors.
It was.
Is allowed to do the re-inspections. I don't know if they're going to do the condos or not, but here I am, I guess. I'm just concerned, and I agree with the audit process. I welcome it immensely because there are a lot of inspection processes that are going on.
Are you an insurance agent?
I'm in between. I work for 35 different insurance agents throughout the state of Florida. And we
You're a broker?
No, I'm a contractor.
Okay.
I'm an insurance contractor. And we inspect. We're kind of middle now.
Oh, yeah.
So I work with insurance agents. I work for...
That's why I want to shoot you. Just kidding. Well, I agree. I can guarantee you that the requirements for our inspectors have the word Walmart is not in there anywhere. I promise that. The 1802 form that was just released for use was from the Office of Insurance Regulation. And we helped to try to get them, and for everybody, this is a form that is required by the Office of Insurance Regulation. The law actually requires the Office of Insurance Regulation to make a form that will standardize the information that is used by insurance carriers to provide wind mitigation credits. So the first version of the form, we believed, was a little lacking. So we've been working with the Office of Insurance Regulation to improve the standard requirements for documenting mitigation features. They released that new form just a couple of days ago, but that's not a citizen's form. That's actually something that was made developed by the Office of Insurance Regulation. And we're putting it into production as required from the office. But I will tell you that the standards that we are setting for our inspections that we pay for are our own, because since we're paying for an inspection, we can make the standards whatever we want. We can make the standards for the qualifications of the inspectors much more rigid. We can make the standards for the documentation that's provided to support wind mitigation features much more substantial than the 1802 form, and we can require very clear and simple explanations about what differences are found, and that's what we're working towards. And I think our pilot program that we did about 700 or 800 reinspections helped us to understand how we can do that better, and it's something that we will continue to try to get better at and will get better at and learn from the process. But our goal is to get it done right and to make sure that the people that we're sending out there are qualified, trained, and that the documentation that we receive fully supports the features. For residential, for example, it's very simple for us to get pictures of roof-to-wall connections, require those pictures with rulers up in the, you know, up in the attic and roof substructure to support nail spacing, nail size, depth of plywood, the actual pictures of the roof-to-wall connections. So when we have that all documented and very detailed in an inspection report that we can share with our policyholders, there won't be any questions about what features are there and what credits are being given and why. It'll be so well documented and supported that it'll help everybody in the process. And what I'm telling our folks is that if we do that and we do that right, this is going to be a very successful program. But if we don't do that, I'm going to kill somebody. That's what I told them. So because the whole thing's going to blow up. And it's so important that we get that done and we get that done right. And they're right behind you, sir, first, and then you. Yes, sir.
What you're saying is you're going to have these inspectors come out with a resume that documents their experience and their qualifications, and that resume is going to be attached to the inspection report.
Absolutely not. What I'm telling you is that we're going to...
How would the Tree Condo Association know that?
Well,
they won't know unless you tell them. So it's your responsibility.
It's my responsibility to choose the people that know what they're doing. And we're committed to that. And when you receive this report, what I'm telling you is it's going to be so well documented, you don't care.
I want to see the qualifications of the people.
So if I provide you with a very detailed, you're shaking your head. I'm not even done yet.
I want to see the qualifications.
You know, I guess we could help you do that.
Okay.
Am I like? Well, all right. I'm going to finish what I was going to say just because I can't help myself. But when we give you this report, if you have any problems with it, you can let us know. But I think our goal is to have it so well documented that it's going to be apparent what the feature is and whether or not it qualifies for credit. It's going to be apparent and it's going to be clear and it's going to be obvious based upon the documentation standards that we're requiring what the feature is and how it's classified. And if you have a question about that or a problem with that, we'll also have a way for you to call us and tell us. It'll be all outlined as part of this process. If we find something different, we're going to send you some communication with the inspection that describes what those differences are, what we found, and what we're going to do about it. And if you disagree with us, here's what you can do. Okay, I don't know how the process would work if I asked every, you know, policyholder to approve the qualifications of the inspectors that we're going to send out. It just doesn't work that way. So, what I will commit to you is that we will have a process that shares the information with you, is open and transparent, and if you have any disagreements, we'll have a process for you to disagree with us and get us information. So our goal is to get it right. We just want to get it right. And we know our duty is to ensure that the risks that we are providing coverage for the state of Florida, for all of us, are rated properly and that the risk characteristics are properly identified. And that's all we're trying to do. Because we honestly believe that that is our duty as the stewards of this program for the state of Florida. Right. And that's why we're in the middle of this program. We are required to accept a form. The law requires us, and we have been accepting that from trained professionals that the law requires. And so now, if those professionals haven't been providing what we need, we're going back and determining, you know, what.
You paid the first person $90 to try to do the right
thing. Right. We didn't pay them.
Oh, we did.
Yes.
Okay. So you're saying that inspection wasn't accurate?
It may not be.
Okay, and now you're saying that the new people that you're going to send out to do, are we going to pay them again to do it accurately? Who's going to pay them to do the second time?
Citizens is going to pay for that inspection.
And then we're going to pay because you have to double pay because we already paid. So I'm saying, where's all this money going to be absorbed for the extra inspection?
I understand what you're saying. But we are, you know, right now we are where we are, and we can talk about how we got here, and we can talk about all that. But it's important for us to recognize that there are, you know, we have a million policies. We give $700 million in mitigation credits. We believe that there could be some misinformation that's been provided to us, so it's our duty to go after it and to try to correct it, and that's what we're doing. Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, sir.
I'm a little confused, so maybe you can straighten this out. I think I hear that there's a form that's required by state insurance that's going to cover wind mitigation, and that by anybody that wants to get that in a copy.
Yes.
And then I think I hear that Citizens is going to have its own more rigorous form, which would say that any insurance company, Citizens being one, is going to have their more rigorous form to be filled out as well in order to really get wind mitigation insurance from whoever's going to actually get it for you. And there's no correlation between the two. I mean, there is, but there's no required correlation between the two. One is one and one is the other. They both develop separately. And they both are incumbent on the unit owner in order to get wind mitigation. Is that right?
No. There are two things, and I apologize. We're kind of going fast and furious, and there's a lot of information here. But the Office of Insurance Regulation is required by law to put out a form that all carriers have to accept in order for a policyholder to qualify and get wind mitigation credits. And they did that. And now there's that form. So if you, and that's what we're giving mitigation credits on right now. By law, I'm sorry? It's the 1802 form? Right. The Office of Insurance Regulation 1802 form. And so that's, if it's filled out by the appropriate level of professional, we're required by law to allow those credits and to give those credits. And that's where we are today. That form has been modified, and recently an update came out that has a little more stringent requirements. So all carriers are still required to accept that form in its new form, in its updated form, if it's filled out by the appropriate level of professional, licensed professional. Carriers have to accept that and provide for these credits. What I said about what our reinspection will do, and that's all you have to do to get and qualify for mitigation credits. The standards that we're setting for the inspections that we pay for, I was just trying to make the distinction that we're going to go after the exact same information, but we're just going to do it in a way that we believe better documents the existence and and better classifies the risk characteristics or the features of a building and whether they qualify for those wind mitigation credits or not. Because it's you won't have to do both. You only have to do one. And our goal is to be able to provide the information necessary to improve the process as we move forward, to share the information that we get and the results with the Office of Insurance Regulation and with everyone else that, you know, you have these standards out there that are required by law that we've been following. Now we're going to do a little work on our own to help you understand how successful or not successful that's been, and maybe that if bad information has been coming in or flowing from that process, come up with recommendations on how it could be improved to get better at the whole process.
Let me see if I understand that. You're saying there will be two forms. One of them will be the form that you are becoming a little more rigorous about how you take the information, what you're looking for. That form is going to be filled out and used by you for a lot of things, but it's not going to be used in order to do wind mitigation for an individual unit owner, because the 1802 is going to take care of that, and that's all he has to do.
May I try?
Please.
Okay.
I need help.
Here's what actually happened. Florida has, for many years, supported and encouraged policy owners to mitigate their property, to protect their property against wind damage. And the way it encouraged you to do that is it required all insurance companies to give policyholders credits when they put up shutters or constructed their homes in a way that would mitigate against wind damage. So the stage was set years ago for people like you and me to try to do things to reduce our risk of loss due to wind. Okay, so the state says we want to encourage people to mitigate their homes. And the way we're going to encourage them is we're going to require companies to give them premium credits for that. And we're going to have a uniform form that every insurance company is going to have to accept and to use to give those wind credits. And the state promulgates this single form that every company has to accept. So if I got a piece of paper from you and it says this house has shutters and it's got a retrofitted door and it's got hurricane-resistant glass, if this piece of paper says that, I have to accept it as true. And I have to give a credit based on this piece of paper. What we have found is, in some instances, and other companies have the same experience, that piece of paper is wrong. Although a licensed contractor said it was true, or some other MySafe Florida home inspector said it was true, it's not true. So what we're doing is we're still going to give the credits based on that piece of paper, but we're going to validate, trust and verify. We're going to validate that what's on that piece of paper is accurate. And so if we have in our underwriting file an 1802 that says there's hurricane-resistant glass and says there's shutters, and we send our inspector out there and he says, here's the picture. It doesn't have what the form says it does. We're going to write you and say, here's what your form told us. Here's what our inspector found. Here are the pictures that support what we think is true. Tell us whether we're right or wrong. We have documentation that shows you don't get this credit. So why are you getting the credit? If there's a dispute, we have a process for you to correspond with us and try to get it worked out. If what you have represented on your 1802 form is right, fine. You can still get a copy of the report to show what kind of features your home has. So there's only one form. We're simply verifying that what's on the form is correct, so that we are properly giving credits where credits are due. And actually, it could go both ways. Our inspection could say, you're not getting all the credits you deserve. Or it could say, you're getting credits you don't deserve. And we'll give you an opportunity to take appropriate action to be able to justify and to earn those credits. And if you don't, when your policy renews, the credit's going to be taken away.
Is this the same thing, or is we will expect to have an inspector come out at some point with your 1802 in hand and say, let me take a look at
this? I'll let Paul answer. I think that our goal would be to inspect every property that now has a wind mitigation credit, unless it's something that's obvious from the year built or something that we know just by looking at the file that it would have that credit. So the pilot project was sort of a sample, but the pilot project has shown us that there are probably a lot of errors on these 1802 forms, and because that affects the premium we collect. And because you remember I said in the beginning, if we don't have enough premium to pay claims, we have to assess. We need to make certain that the right people are getting the right credits and that all of us don't end up being assessed because some person claimed a feature and got a credit and they didn't deserve it. So it's important to all of us that everybody pay the right premium and that if you deserve a credit, you receive that credit. And if you don't, you don't. Yes, sir.
Well, what you're saying is that the initial people that the insurance company sent out, because certainly none of us signed off on these insurance inspections, those people that were sent out that we paid for to have the initial one done, if it was done inaccurately, that you're going to find the inaccuracy. What's the accountability on the people that did the initial inspection for doing it inaccurately? Nothing.
Well, it's not something that we can enforce against any of those people. I suppose that, right, well, one of the things that I think could be done, and I don't really know what all the categories of people are who were able to provide those inspections for, say, the MySafe Florida Home Program, but those people should, I think, have some license with the state, maybe through the Department of Business and Professional Regulation. So my point would be that potentially, but it's not something that we would be doing. Potentially, those of you who hired a person who had certain credentials to provide you with a report and it turned out to be inaccurate, you may be able to go against that person's license with DBPR. But again, that's not something that we would pursue because you hired those people. And I understand your point, but I'm only saying that that's not our function to prosecute your claim against a person that gave you a false report. Yes, ma'am.
Why should we pay to have
Well, yeah, we're only doing re-inspections for properties that already have the credit. Yes, ma'am.
You know, the discussion is about there are some things that should be known to the policyholder because it's pretty obvious or should be obvious whether it's there or not. So I get that question a lot from the people that are interested in us making these changes, and as I am. But our policyholders are not trained professionals and are not building contractors. Sometimes they're getting an opening protection credit, and all openings have to be protected. But the reason that they may not qualify is because the front door or the garage door may not meet a standard. So I think it's going to be some things that we find that aren't obvious and that would require a little more technical training that I wouldn't expect that we could expect our policyholders to have or to know, especially when we talk about some of the other construction features and the way the roof is connected to the walls and some of the underpinnings of the roof substructure. So whether it was the inspector or the policyholder, our goal right now is just to move forward, improve the process, get good information, share that with our policyholders, give them an inspection report that they can take with them and have that accurately and definitively describes and documents the features of their buildings. Yes, ma'am. And that's a good question. The question is, how often will we require an inspection or a revalidation that the features present actually qualify for credit? And our goal is to get it done once, and once that is documented, only if for some reason we could expect a building feature to change or to... So I don't think it'll take a recurring inspection or an annual or a periodic inspection. Now, once we have it very well documented, that we can rely upon that for the life of the policy. That makes sense? You second, sir, all the way in the back, and then you, sir, and then you, sir.
Yes, it would seem to me that the broadest interpretation of our association has been proactive. We've stayed, however, the buildings seem to have a criteria for
the case. We do have, on the forum themselves, I'm trying to think, and in our underwriting manuals, we do describe what the requirements are to meet and the standards for wind mitigation credits. And your insurance agent should be able any information. Well, I'd like to understand specifically. So maybe if you could get with me after, I'd like to understand your actual. If you give your policy number, and we can talk about exactly what features that you have and what you're trying to accomplish. Is that all right? All right. Agreed. Who did I say was second? Yes, sir. And then you, sir.
Yes. My question was just if I got, according to current law, if I got wind mitigation first came out, did that have an expiration date?
I think the form actually does have a 5-year standard on it. But I will say that if we document a building feature, I don't think we can expect that feature to change. I mean, unless it's improved somehow. But once we document what the roof-to-wall connections are, what the roof shape is, I think we can generally expect that it's going to remain that way and don't have to revalidate that the roof wasn't reattached in some lesser way, So I think we can rely upon, I believe we'll be able to rely upon the information that we get in our very detailed inspection for the life of the policy.
So that's why, this is with citizens, but I'm just curious if I've changed the policies, would I need to get a new insurance company that needs to do inspection?
Well, that's, I think, the standard that was set on the 1802 form that the Office of Insurance Regulation provided is a 5-year standard. So as long as it's less than 5 years old, you should be able to bring that to the new insurance carrier and give that to them and document those are the credits that you qualify for. And then when you have the very detailed inspection, once it occurs from us, I mean, that's going to be something that other carriers would be very interested in getting because it will definitively describe and document the features of a building.
Could that inspection
result in
the extension of the 5 years?
The 5-year standard was set by the Office of Insurance Regulation on their form. I think it's up to each individual carrier to make a determination on whether they would require a new inspection after 5 years or not. But from an underwriter's perspective, I just don't understand. If it's documented that a building has certain features, it's not like those features are going to change. Yes, sir, anyone sure? Well, you know, the law, the question is about the value of the coverage amount, value of policy valuation, how often appraisals are required to be done, and the coverage amount to be validated as 100% replacement cost. Does that accurately describe the question? The law requires, I think, condo associations do it every 36 months. Isn't that the law? Mr. Charles, yes. But our standard is that we have, it's important that we understand what 100% replacement cost is. So we require that when a policy is initiated, we have sufficient evidence to support a reasonable estimate of what 100% replacement cost is. And for us, it's an appraisal that lists what the replacement cost is, or a valuation done by an inspector that is qualified to provide such an estimate through the use of a replacement cost estimating tool. There are many out there that if all the building features are accurately input in, then it will produce a reasonable estimate of what replacement cost is. So we have that requirement when a policy is initiated or when it's written with the application, the coverage is set, and then annually we have an inflation factor that moves the coverage appropriately, we believe, with inflation, and that's all we require. There's no requirement that every so often you revalidate, but it's hugely important that you can constantly, especially for larger condo buildings, that for your own protection, that you constantly that you review as often as you feel like you need to the coverage amount that you have and what the current market conditions show that based upon the cost of labor and materials, what it would cost to replace buildings, and that review is done periodically for your own protection. But we have a mechanism that we rely upon, a reasonable estimate of replacement cost to be determined and used when a policy is initiated, and then at each subsequent renewal, every time the policy renews, we work with Marshall & Swift, who's a leader in the industry in replacement cost technology, and they provide us with inflation factors at the zip code level that we apply to our renewal policies and buildings to move coverage with inflation. So if you don't, and we're happy to review that with you, if you don't agree with what we've done or you believe that your own independent review shows other results, you can provide that evidence to us, because it's hugely important that you all do whatever you need to ensure that the coverage amount that you're carrying is adequate for your needs should the building be destroyed. Yes, sir.
Their credits are going to go away for that roof to wall connection, because I'm pretty sure your form's going to ask for access. If there's no access to the underpayment of that roof structure without time carrying the drywall, the roof to wall connection cannot be verified. So on the checkbox of that form, it's going to have to be access or unbound or accessibility to that particular photograph of credit. I know for a fact pictures of my firm, we actually built a lot of these buildings in Merritt Island and the public engineers, and they have the drawings. But to take care of that issue with your roof, individuals that are really going to want to get all those credits are going to have to pop up engineers and stamp drawings for that property when they go to get their. Any question I have?
Well, can I address that real quick? Did everybody hear that discussion? Because I think one of the things that I struggle with, because, again, we want to make sure that we're getting an accurate representation of what the building characteristics are. So I am very interested in when we got the initial mitigation form, and it was indicated that it was built to a standard that qualifies for credit. How was that determination made? So it's not that we can't, if we can't validate it, how did they validate it? So it's important that's the process that we'll go through, that we'll work with our policyholders to see if there is information that will allow us to get to the same place that the original inspector did. But if there is nothing, then that's what we're concerned about, that the original inspector may have made that indication without properly understanding whether it really met that standard or not.
And the proper way of working is if there is no access, they need to pop up the drawings or go to the building department to have the drawings.
And our process will require our inspector to go to the building department and pull the permits that were used to construct the building, that were used to put roofs on, so we can make sure that we understand how it was done, how the work was done, and whether it meets the standards that it needs to qualify for credit. So getting building permits, pulling that is going to be a huge part of our process, because many of the credits that we're receiving have to do with, you know, roofs that meet the new building code, the 2001 building code. But what we're finding is, you know, after the 05 hurricane, Uncle Frank came and put shingles on, but somehow we have an indication that now it meets the 2001 building code. But it doesn't, because a permit was never pulled, the work was never done to a standard that would allow it to meet the building code requirements, and there's nothing to document it other than the indication that we had to accept on that 1802 form from the licensed professional that we did. So building permits and qualifications and validation of features is a huge important part of this process that we're building.
Also, I have to call, the building was built in the 80s, it had a re-roof, and the permitting contractor came in and put
Right. But again, our question will always be, what documentation was used to support providing those credits in the first place? And if it wasn't available, then you can't make a leap or a guess that it would. We have to have definitive evidence that shows that the work and the construction was done to the standard that would allow it to meet the credit. And secondary water resistance is going to be one that's going to be a good one. Well, we have a limited amount of resources. We can't do it all. We have about 400,000 policies that currently get mitigation credits. Our goal is to start with the ones that we think are more likely to need validation based upon the year of construction, the type of credits that they're currently getting, and then work our way through the best that we can with the resources that we have. Yes, sir.
My limited understanding of our requirements, when we live in Palm Bay, are that we must meet the Palm Bay building requirements and the Palm Bay hurricane mitigation requirements. And we looked that up, they cite the state building code in total.
Okay.
And then they cite the wind mitigation area that you would be in, such that the winds would be expected to be, for instance, in ours 120 only, not the state county. 140, there's a difference in the forces on roofs.
Right.
So, that's where we are as far as the requirements are, far as, in our mind, meeting the city's requirements, which is that's under. Are there any differences in the hurricane limits than from before the state code?
Well, many of the credits that are given are based upon the standards that are set by the 2001 building code. So it just depends on when the building was constructed, to what standard it was constructed, what the building code requirements were at the time. But there are differences, but there are similarities. So we just have to understand the specific circumstances of a building, when it was constructed, to what building code standard it was set, and then compare those to the standards required by to qualify for credits and make a determination on what credits it would qualify for.
So I think I hear you say the standards at 1988 were this.
Yes.
That's good for you. And the standards now, 2010, are different. And we're going to base our wind mitigation requirements on the 2010 standards. So, If you did something in 1988, you haven't upgraded, you're going to have to upgrade in order to meet the Florida State Building Code for 2010
right.
in the area of wind mitigation.
Well, you know, the most current version of the building code for Florida is 2001. I think it came out in 2002, but that's the way it always works, I guess. But many of the standards to qualify for credit are based upon the standards of the 2001 building code. It is true. So if your building isn't built to the standards set by the 2001 building code, oftentimes it won't qualify for any credits unless you have opening protections or have retrofitted in some way. But the credits are there, and our the whole intention, as Suzanne so eloquently described, as she always does, that building owners will take steps to strengthen their buildings to protect against wind damage. And so I think that the standards set by the newer building code do try to do that, try to accomplish strengthening buildings to resist better against wind. And so if a home or a building was constructed not to those standards, then the whole idea about these credits is to offer some incentive to have a building strengthened to meet those standards in order to have less wind damage in a wind event.
Yeah, I understand that.
Okay.
The key in my mind is it's still a new set of Florida State Building Code standards. It's not something else that you've added onto it as far as wind mitigation standards. Is that right?
I think essentially that is right. And the question is, whether the credits that are being allowed are in addition to building code standards or are more consistent with the building code standards. And I think that the answer is that the credits that are allowed are more consistent with current building code standards. Yes, sir, in the back?
I wanted to change gears, if you don't mind, just for a minute.
You know, we do have all these written questions, too.
Covering the questions as it relates to wind damage. Citizens policy.
Okay.
Right now, there is no building ordinance and law. There are some standard carriers out there, ordinance and law for wind damage, but they're very limited as far as who they provide, what master policy. What happens is, Congress that really need this coverage, left out. They cannot obtain it. And we all know from Hurricane Andrew that building ordinance and law. There are places out there that will actually give you, April replacement cost, appraisal, built to code replacement cost. And I know it's 40% replacement cost. They have to talk about adding that or making that coverage available.
So the question is about law and ordinance coverage, and this is a coverage that is on some property policies. It provides that if a building is damaged and it costs more money to build, rebuild it because of requirements in the ordinances and laws and building codes, that there's additional coverage available to allow the construction to carry on to meet those standards. Right. So right now, Citizens doesn't offer that coverage, and I don't see Citizens offering that coverage in the foreseeable future for condos, buildings. So I think that's why it's hugely important that you ensure that the replacement cost and the coverage amount that you carry would be sufficient to reconstruct the building to the appropriate code that is in force at the time, and whatever modifications or whatever new standards would have to be met, that the evaluation technique that's used, that you work with your appraiser, you work with the folks that you're hiring to help you determine what the replacement cost is of the structure, considers all of the building code considerations, I did it again, that need to be taken into account to set the appropriate value. If you carry $1.4 million of coverage and you have a total loss, you're going to get $1.4 million. That is a requirement of Florida law. It's called the value policy law. And if you have a total loss, you will get the value of your policy. It has nothing to do with like, kind, or quality. It's just the law that if you carry an amount of coverage and you have a total loss, you will get that amount of coverage. Right. Well, and oftentimes that because of code requirements, it doesn't require a total loss in order for those new code requirements to be enforced. It could be oftentimes around half or 50% is damaged, and then all of the work that's done needs to be to a certain code, or even bring the entire building up to meet those code standards. So, well, your insurance policy with Citizens would pay for it if you carried the appropriate amount of coverage that would allow you the coverage amount necessary to rebuild or reconstruct the building to whatever code, with whatever code considerations need to be considered as part of that coverage.
Is that right?
Yes. It must be, I have a huge incentive to give you misinformation. It's this great big bonus programs that we have at Citizens for. Well, I guess since I'm not that's not my understanding, but I may need to go back and make sure that I have it correct, because I am under the impression that if it is required by that it be done, that our policy would provide the coverage necessary up to the coverage A amount, up to the amount of coverage that you're carrying, to make the repairs to the standards that are required. I understand that. Well, but it also provides an additional coverage amount over and above what you carry as part of, the coverage A amount. We could do more cards. So why don't I make sure that I have my story straight on that one, and I will get with Mr. Charles and clarify all of the discussion that we've had about ordinance and law and ordinance, to make sure that the information that I've provided to you is correct. And if it's not, for some reason, then I will I'll own it and communicate that to Mr. Charles, who can get that information out to everyone. Can you address what is going on currently with premium rate trends? Can we expect stable rates, higher, lower, etc.?
Will I take this one?
Oh,
take a break.
Sure. Here, let me. You may or may not know that. I have to stand next to him. Don't go very far, because here's in your pocket.
I know. Okay, right here.
All right, does this work? Okay. I'm sure you know that by Florida law, our rates have been frozen for several years, and we are just in 2010 starting to implement a gradual increase in our premiums, again, specified by law to be no more than 10%. I don't know for this area what that trend will look like for the coming years. So I can't specifically talk about your policies, but we do have the ability to increase premiums up to 10% a year until we reach actuarially sound rates. So I would suspect, but I don't know, I would suspect that you could anticipate some gradual increase in your premium over the next several years, capped at that 10% level.
Per year?
Yes. Until we reach actuarially sound rates, and then we'll make another rate filing and say whether we still need additional rates going forward or whether we're good where we are.
How far away are you from the rate?
It varies by policy type, by territory. I think. It depends again on whether it's a wind-only policy or a multi-peril policy. I'm making this up because I can't really remember. I want to say for the multi-peril, it was in the
40s.
Yeah,
statewide.
40s statewide, and for wind-only, it might be in the 50s, 55% statewide. But again, huge variations and huge fluctuations based on what type of policy you're talking about, like a a tenant policy different from a homeowner's policy, different from a condo unit owner's policy. So huge variations in those numbers by territory, by policy type. But I think the good news is, even though we have a fairly large indicated rate need, the legislature has said, let's implement that over time on a modest basis so that folks like you and me can budget and plan and understand that you'll have a gradual and hopefully tolerable increase in premiums over time at a speed and pace that you can plan for. So that's where we are on rates.
Where'd they go?
If I were to interpret that without any other information, talking about increasing the rates 10% for 9 years, unless there's a super set of hurricanes that come through, then all that's...
Well, of course, you know that rates are not based on whether we have a hurricane event. Your rates don't go up just because we have a hurricane event. In fact, the law doesn't allow companies to recover the sums that they've paid in claims for an event in the following year. That's not how it's done. You look at, you project what you anticipate your losses to be in future years, and absolutely you look at historical data to help you make that projection. But it's not a one for one. Like if we pay $5 million in hurricane claims in a year, we don't turn around the next year and increase rates by $5 million.
Understand.
Okay.
So re-look at your rates if you had a huge problem this year with two hurricanes. You would not recover
not really.
This year, but you would be re-looking at how short you are from the total requirement to stay solvent. Citizens come back 2 years from now with a different set of requirements, probably meeting the 10% cap that the state's talking about, but now for 7 or 8 years out.
Again, not really. We absolutely would look at historical trends. We'd look at what we actually paid. I'm sorry?
For non-cat.
Yeah, for non-cat, for non-catastrophe losses. It doesn't matter. I think what you need to know is that you set rates based on your historical data and your projection of what your future losses are going to be. And the goal of an actuarially sound rate is that you have enough money in premiums to cover your expected losses and expenses for the period of time that rate's in effect. That's what you're looking for. Those, your expected losses and expenses certainly are colored by what your past has been, but it's a projection into the future. So for you folks, again, you're looking at up to a 10% increase maybe for the next few years until we reach actuarially sound rates, and then we make... Every year we're going to make a filing with the Office of Insurance Regulation to try to see if we're on track, if the rates that we've projected are accurate, and if we need more or less premium. So we kind of calibrate them each year, understanding we have this 10% cap, until we get to an actuarially sound rate. My pleasure. Can you explain the difference between storm surge and flood? My condo is on the ocean. It was never clear to me. I mean, I think storms, my answer would be storm surge, as I understand it, is flood. And, of course, the importance of that is that our policy doesn't cover storm surge or flood. That is provided by the National Flood Insurance Program. So if you need protection from rising water, storm surge, flood, you need to buy a policy from the National Flood Insurance Program. I hope that was a good answer. Citizens requires an appraisal. Florida law requires appraisers to be licensed. Residential appraisers are limited to appraising up to 4 units. Why doesn't Citizens require certified general appraisers to provide appraisers?
Appraisals, probably.
Appraisals. I don't know the. I don't understand that question. Do you understand that question?
I don't.
Would the person who asked this question amplify it for me? Thank you.
Yes, I am an appraiser, and I'm a state certified general appraiser, and that allows me to appraise commercial property as well as residential. a certified residential appraiser is limited by Florida law to appraising vacant land for up from 1 to 4 residential units. So a building with more than 4 units, a certified residential appraiser is not qualified to appraise by Florida law. I know you're not a state agency, but you're following state law by saying we require an appraisal. And in Florida, an appraisal is something that's done by an appraiser, and the license law says if you've got a condo association property, rental appraiser to appraise it for you. Citizens doesn't require that. Well, appraisals will accept appraisals from residential appraisers who by Florida law are qualified to provide that.
So the question is related to appraisers and appraisals that Citizens accepts, and that Florida law has requirements for units that are over, or buildings that have over 4 units, that they be general appraisers. But Citizens will accept something from not a general appraiser on buildings that are over 4 units. And our goal, again, is to get a reasonable estimate of what the replacement cost of a building is. And what we do is, if a policyholder has gone through the cost and expense and provided, you know, had someone come out and provide this information, and we look at what information was used, how it was documented, what tool it was input in, and what value was generated from that. And if it was done reasonably well, we're not going to ask the policyholder to go out and get a different appraisal or additional information. We're going to accept what was provided and what was paid for to ensure that, because again, our only goal is to get a reasonable estimate of what a replacement cost of a building is. And if information is provided to us in a way that allows that to occur, then we'll accept it.
Please. I think this follows in line with the questions about the inspector and the requirements for those professionals. And I think the fur would fly if there were a claim and there were a dispute as to the amount of coverage that should have been required. And during that dispute, the question comes up, well, who told you how much? And if someone says, you know, this guy over here told me, well, are they licensed and qualified? And I know that's two separate categories, licensed and qualified. You don't necessarily have to be one to be the other. But I think it opens the door to problems if a condo association with 83 units is accepting an appraisal done by someone who, by Florida law, is not permitted or qualified to provide that information. And as a state, as a government entity, it seems like you would be interested in promoting, just like you do with the requirements for your inspectors, it seems like you would have the same standards to apply to the folks that are putting that number on the policy.
And, you know, with appraisals and inspections related to valuation, there's not a clearly definitive answer that can be relied upon every time. So there are a variety of methods that are available to policyholders, and we allow policyholders to use whatever method that they believe is as long as it's reasonable, whatever method that they want to, whatever professional that they have chosen to provide them with an estimate of what the replacement cost of their structure is. If they paid for that, and that's what they would like to rely upon, and they provide that to us, and it seems to properly document the features, the square footage, the size, all of the characteristics of the building. It seems to use a tool that is provided by an organization like MSB or Exactware or another mechanism that, when it's input in, would generate a reasonable estimate of replacement cost. We're going to accept it, and we're not going to require the policyholder to follow a very detailed prescribed method, because there are a variety of ways to come up with the answer, and it's not definitive, and it is an estimate. So it's been our philosophy to work with our policyholders to look at the information that they have that they would like to rely upon to set their building value and to review that and accept it if it's a reasonable estimate.
Our complex has 250 units. 50% have shutters, 50% do not. Is there a law to force those who do not have shutters to purchase them? No. What savings could the complex expect?
If they did all have
shutters.
Got to be the question, right?
Yeah, I assume that's the question. Right, again, hard to say, because it varies dramatically. Can you give an estimate?
I can't.
We can't give you an estimate.
I could if...
I'm sorry.
If you want, whoever wrote this question, if you want to come up to us afterwards, we can tell you, if you give us your policy number, I can tell you exactly what you could expect. Or you can just call our customer service or get with your agent. Either way, we can give you the information that you need to understand if you were to get opening protections and meet the standards for that credit, what impact it would have on your premium. We can absolutely get that very specific number for you and your policy.
Please explain, I think it's accessible. Please explain accessible feature of a Citizens policy. Why does the policy not state this? I think I understand the question. If I get it wrong, whoever wrote it could correct me. When I opened up this meeting, I talked about the fact that Citizens has the power to assess if the premium and the investment income and the reinsurance that we get is not sufficient to pay all the claims that we've incurred. And we've had to assess in the past. That has actually occurred. The way that the assessment works is governed by Florida law, which has changed over time. The law now says that there's a tiered structure of assessments. And we have a pretty good graphic on our website that you can go look at that explains how this works. But essentially, if you are a Citizens policyholder, you are going to be assessed at a higher percentage than if you had coverage in the voluntary market, because the law requires that. And the law says if we have a deficit, which means we don't have enough premium and other assets to pay the claims that we've got, if we have a deficit, we assess our policyholders first. You're in the first tier of assessments. And you could be assessed up to 15% of your premium. And you could be assessed for all three accounts. So if we had a huge deficit and we had losses that made us unable to fund our claims in all three of the accounts that we have, you could have an assessment that would be 45% of your current premium. That is a very unlikely scenario, but it is a possibility if there's a bad enough storm and we have a deficit in all three accounts, you could be assessed up to 45% of your premium. If that amount is not enough to cure the deficit we have, then we have the statutory authority to assess other policyholders in Florida up to 6% of their premium for each account we have, so their liability could be 18% of their total premium. And then we have the ability to make emergency assessments, which are multi-year assessments that are generally going to be small. There's an emergency assessment out there now that I think is 1%. It's a relatively small one. So the way Florida has set this up is the law wants us to have actuarially sound rates. We're required to operate using actuarially sound rates, but we know we don't have them quite yet. And so we have this stair step to achieve that objective. But even if we had actuarially sound rates, again, you heard me say that that definition for us is that we want to have enough premium to cover our expected losses and expenses. But that's not an exact number. It's not a determinable number. It's an estimate. So it is possible, even if we had actuarially sound rates, that we could still have a deficit. And so the law is trying to push us to having actuarially sound rates to reduce our reliance on assessments after an event. The way that some people describe it is it's pay me now or pay me later. And there is some concern that people like you don't understand that you might be subject to an assessment down the road. And so the legislature is trying to gradually increase our rates to make them actuarially sound and reduce our reliance on post-event assessments. But I think the intent of this question is, what is the assessment chart? And I tried to explain it to you and how it works. And why is that not in our policy? I can't remember if the application has this information in it that notifies you that you might be subject to an assessment. Does it? I think it might be in the application, but even now as we speak today, there is legislation being proposed that would require that at the time that you apply for coverage with Citizens, and I think it also requires us to provide it at renewal, we're required to give you a notice that says, here's how we operate, and you might have to pay an assessment amount, and here's what it could be. So there is some legislative intent, if it passes, that would require us to specifically, your agent would have to provide you with the form, and you'd have to sign it and acknowledge you understand that you might be subject to an assessment. But I do believe that our application makes that clear, and it may be that the legislature requires us to even go further than that and require that you sign an acknowledgement at the time that you get coverage. It's complicated, but it's a result of the fact that we are an organization that was created from two other organizations. We have what's called the high-risk account, which are the wind-only policies that I talked about that were formerly those policies covered by the Florida Windstorm Underwriting Association. And then the former Florida Residential Property and Casualty Joint Underwriting Association had two accounts, a commercial account and a personal lines account. The commercial account is the condo associations and homeowners associations and that sort of thing. So each of those is a separate account, and you can be assessed for a deficit in any of those three accounts.
Oh, sir. Thank you. I needed a break. One of the things I wanted to say about rates is that, you know, the thing that monkeys it up for us and for Florida is hurricanes. The threat of catastrophic hurricane. If you took all states essentially have a citizens type facility to write risks with unique characteristics, whatever the private market doesn't want, to offer insurance protection to those who can't find it. But if you took in every one of those states those facilities and added them up and then doubled it, Citizens is still bigger. And it's because, I believe, of the threat of catastrophic hurricane. Rate setting is pretty academic. Without hurricanes, you take your expected losses, which you can pretty much guess what they're going to be for things like fire and theft. You can look, actuaries can look at past results, look at how risks with similar characteristics have generally performed, what the probabilities of losses are, how much those losses will be, what our expenses will be to operate the business, and all of those non-catastrophic loss categories based upon the policy types that you write, and some of those characteristics and the expenses of running the business can be pretty well determined and estimated very reasonably well. It's the hurricanes are so catastrophic and random that you can't look at what happened in history to make a determination on what your future losses could be. So when Suzanne said that even if we did have actuarially sound rates, we could still have a deficit or an assessment, she's absolutely right. And that's why other carriers or private carriers are finding it so difficult to write in Florida, because when we set hurricane rates or rates for wind, we use models. And that's what the law prescribes. That's what the Office of Insurance Regulation prescribes, that you can't look at history and trying to determine what your future hurricane losses will be. We use models that estimate over what our average losses will be year after year after year. But those are averages over like a super long period of time, over hundreds of years. So if we're charging an actuarially sound rate and we have a devastating storm, we're not going to have enough money to pay all of those claims, because those rates are set based upon averages over a very long period of time. So I just thought that, you know, that was, I guess, an important discussion or a part of the whole rate setting methodology and kind of at the real core of what why the law created citizens and why we're here. Yes, sir. Well, because as I said, you're going to have years where you have no losses. You're going to have years where you have huge losses. We're talking about averages over hundreds of years. So it's, yeah, hundreds of years. Well, so it's allowing that those dollars to build up for when a storm does occur, when we have $500 billion worth of exposure that we are responsible for. We have, you know, modeled that we could have a storm probability that could we could have a $20 or $30 billion loss. So it's important that as citizens we allow that surplus or our dollars that flow in times when we don't have hurricanes to build up, so we do have the dollars in the bank to pay claims when we do have hurricanes. And you don't believe me, and I don't know why.
Hurricanes go in cycles.
Well, they're just too random. They're random, unpredictable, catastrophic. It's what's causing the whole problem.
Chaos theory gains, but the thing is, moving averages would be better than 100 years worth of averages. And I don't understand why the state doesn't use moving averages as a statistical base for setting its rates.
I don't know. What do you mean a moving average?
A moving average is an average for the last 15 years, and then tomorrow or next year, we take another year off and then put another year on the other end. And so we keep moving it out, but it is not 100 years before.
Well, again, it's not the hurricane loss prediction can't rely upon past history. There's not enough information. There's not enough data to understand what the cycles will be, when storms will hit, what the probabilities are. That's why models are used to try to estimate it going forward and try to understand over the long period of time how much money would have to be collected to cover losses over a longer period of time.
I'm just pointing out that models have become very sophisticated.
They have.
If you've got a model that still stands on hundreds of years worth of data, you probably don't have you probably don't have as predictive a base as you could have.
Understood. Yes, sir?
In that regard, I think there have been some proposals on the floor, but we like the solution, you know, that the ideal solution is a coastal state for citizens, the complication being getting in and done between the states. But are you aware if there's any efforts going in that direction for Florida to get with the other coastal states?
I've been here for 15 years, and we've been talking about it for 15 years. I came from South Carolina where we were talking about it then. There are perennially bills in Congress to create either a national catastrophic plan or even there's coastal compacts that have been considered. You know, the devil's in the details, and the problem with that is, if I'm Iowa, I'm not interested in helping Florida with its hurricane exposure, and if I'm Mississippi, I'm not really wild about having Florida in my coastal. I'm sorry.
Their sizes are just
yeah.
So much bigger. Than
right. So the problem is we're so developed, and we got such exposure here. Multiple times what almost anybody else has, that we want to do it because we want to spread our exposure and they don't want our exposure. So I think, we're going to keep talking. We've been talking for 20 years and we'll probably continue to talk. And hopefully there will be some federal solution, but that has, again, a lot of complexity and difficulty. And you know, I really thought maybe after Katrina something would happen because that was so devastating and so obvious that the responding after the fact and is ineffective and very inefficient, very costly. I thought that might be the backdrop against which we talk about let's prepare up front and let's put something together that would address a Katrina-like situation on the front end rather than after the fact, but that didn't happen. I'm going to make you do this one.
Oh, good. Since you don't provide leak claims except in certain circumstances, what do you recommend for coverage for a condo? example, water leak damage from cement walls not covered. You know, one of the things that property policies in general don't provide coverage for are maintenance issues or defects in materials or workmanship. And I think maybe that's the scenario or what's being described here. So it's important that you understand that the property insurance policies that you have, whether it's with Citizens or someone else, provide coverage for sudden, direct, and accidental occurrences that damage your property, and that anything that would have to do with a maintenance issue or a defect in materials or defect in workmanship is something that the policy is not designed to cover and doesn't provide coverage for. So it's important that I don't know of any policy or type of insurance mechanism that's available for that other than some kind of a maintenance policy, I would imagine. Does that answer the question?
Okay, we have four index cards written in a very precise hand, all about our underwriting manual. And I don't know if y'all care about this, but because it is, these seem to be very specific. Have there been any changes or amendments to this manual? The Commercial Lines Account Underwriting Manual 2006 edition. I would say, without knowing the answer to that question, yes, there have been changes since 2006. Please identify every statute, ordinance, and all insurance policy language that affects citizens' underwriting decision. Copies and emails would be great. Well, I can only tell you that we have an entire statute 627.351 sub 6 that's about 35 pages long that applies to citizens. There are countless statutes that apply to citizens. I don't know that I have one compendium of every statute, ordinance, and every policy language that affects our underwriting decisions. But if whoever asked this question would come up afterwards, we'll see if we can...
Or if there's more clarification.
Yeah, or more clarification to this question, we'll be happy to... Because I think the next one even may be getting to the issue here. How and by whom are changes and amendments made to the underwriting manual? What triggers the need for change? And then what's the appeal procedure from an adverse underwriting decision on your property? So let's talk about the underwriting manual and how it's created and how it's changed. Paul Palumbo.
Oh, good. I know you're good. Citizens underwriting manual requires, any change to the manual require board approval, and we file with the Office of Insurance Regulation. Oftentimes, changes are made because of requirements of law change, or there is a business decision that's made to modify the underwriting requirements in some way or for some reason, or to get better at valuation or some other mechanism. So there's a variety of ways that ideas can come or that changes can be initiated. I would say most oftentimes it's by law. And we have an underwriting committee who review those changes, make recommendations to our board, who must approve the change, our board of governors. And then if those changes are approved, they're filed with the Office of Insurance Regulation. And if they're approved by the office, then they are initiated. And then describe the appeal procedure for an adverse underwriting decision on the property. You know, all of our guidelines and underwriting requirements are, again, prescribed and outlined in our underwriting manual. And our intention is to follow those guidelines because it's our duty to manage the book of business or these policies for all of us to the best that we can, to the standards that are set in those underwriting guidelines. And if there's something that's misunderstood or needs to be corrected, we work those out every day with additional information that's provided to gain a better understanding of risk, of the characteristics of a risk or whether it does or doesn't meet the standards set by our underwriting guidelines. Is there any specific information that you'd like with regard to that question? All right, very good.
We We prepared this little brochure that I spoke about earlier and tried to take some of the questions that had been provided to us from this group and put them in this document. And I think that this dovetails on something that I think was covered in the beginning of this presentation. It really is helpful to us to have as much information about the property available at the time that a loss occurs. So if you can document the condition of your property by a video, if you have information available about who we should contact if there's a loss, it's really helpful to us to work with a condo association that's taken the time to be prepared. So I think this document says, be prepared. Get all your documentation together. Be ready for the storm season. Take photos. Document the condition of your property so that when we come adjust the loss, we'll know what it looked like before the event. So the more time that you can take now to prepare, the better prepared we'll be to service your claim if a loss occurs. We tried to touch on some of the things that seemed important to you to describe what the duties of the condo association are in the event of a loss, how to make the claims process smoother, and we actually worked with our commercial claims staff to help provide this information to you to make certain that what we said to you is what they would expect us to say and what they're looking for in the event that a claim is filed. So this document, we hope, is helpful. And then this document is something that, if we had time, we would have put magnets on the back of them so you could put it on your refrigerator because it has our claims number at the bottom. And some other helpful hints in the days before the coming of hurricane season. The other documents are a document about the Florida Market Assistance Plan, which you may or may not know is an online and telephone service that helps individuals who need coverage try to find an insurance company to provide them with that coverage, and then a little flyer on the National Flood Insurance Program. Those are all the documents we brought. We've I think, answered all the questions that have been asked in writing, but I think if there's time and there are other questions, we will be happy to answer them. We're running out of video.
Okay. Well, I'd like to thank citizens for coming today. I hope they answered some of our questions, if not all of them. And to let everybody know, the DVD recording of this will be available for $15. Just email it to me. You can get my email through the website. We have a board meeting this afternoon after this. We have room for about 6 guests. Also, I want to apologize to everyone for not having the goodies here today. The corporation that was supposed to sponsor this meeting did a no-show, okay? And we're just used to our good people of ServPro, who is never late and has always done the right thing. And I would like to thank Kim Robertson from ServPro, the owner of ServPro of South and West Brevard, for always being so, sending people down here and putting out such a nice spread. I would like to thank you very much, Kim. Our next meeting will be May 15th, and the topic is Board of Directors Rights and Responsibilities. It will be given by Taylor and Carl's attorneys at law, and also incorporated in this program for all the CAMs. If the CAMs come to this course at the time, they will receive a 2-hour CAM credit, the way the program is being set up. So you may want to pass the word around to your property managers and have them show up for the meeting. We would appreciate it. Again, thank you, citizens, for coming, and thank you all for attending. I appreciate it. Have a great day.